Many of you here have seen me present on this data set before, although this is, and it's been, we've worked with it now for a while, and to the extent that we now call it, we've now actually named the study, the National, or the Massachusetts Mental Health Criminal Justice Cohort Study. I want to first point out that, there was supposed to be a picture here that didn't get in, but this work was extremely dependent on, as we say, the perseverance, the guidance, and the consistently genial mentoring of our dear colleague Steve Banks, whose idea it was really to embark on this particular methodological approach, and who really was the guy who made it happen. So. I think you've probably seen a number of these testimonials. I know Mary Evans did one yesterday, and I'm sure there have probably been others, and there will continue to be probably over the next few years as he worked with any number of people in our field and was a major, major figure. The Massachusetts Mental Health Cohort Study was designed to study arrests among a group of individuals who had serious and persistent mental illness and who were actually met a certain level of disability by virtue of their meeting the criteria for receiving services from the state mental health agency, which requires that a person have a history of have a diagnosis, an established diagnosis of a major mental disorder, which is usually one of the major severe Axis I disorders. In some cases, a couple of the Axis II disorders. Also, a history of hospitalization and demonstrated functional impairment. And the focus of this study has been on a number of aspects of criminal justice involvement, including arrests, the charges for which people are arrested, and as we're going to talk today, the temporal patterns of that involvement, and also correlations with service use, which have turned out to be difficult to do, and also somewhat, when we have been able to do it, somewhat disappointing in terms of what mental health services have as an effect on this phenomenon. The inclusion criteria, as I said, for the cohort were that the individuals received either case management or inpatient treatment or residential services from the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health during a one-year period that spanned July of 1991 to the end of June of 1992. It's actually a Massachusetts fiscal year, and it was easy to kind of arrange things in that way. So these people are all adult service recipients, and they're 18 years of age or older, which also means that their arrests were no longer juvenile arrests. They were dealt with within the adult courts and the adult criminal justice system. The arrest data that we used were obtained from the Massachusetts Criminal History Systems Board's Criminal Offender Record Information, or the CORI system, as it's affectionately known in Massachusetts for those of us who have to work with it. There were 13,816 of these individuals in this cohort. We had about 3,800 of them, or just under 30%, were arrested at least one time during this during a 10-year observation period, and they compiled what I think of as a kind of staggering number: 41,000 charges. Which, of course, a person can be charged with multiple offenses on any given arrest, and many people were. But what did surprise me was that. That felonies outnumbered misdemeanors almost 2-1, which kind of belies the assumption that was made back in the 1990s and early 2000s that really most people with serious and persistent mental illness are just arrested for these kind of nuisance offenses, and that really, you know, all they need is a place to live and some adequate mental health services, and they'll be fine. This turned out not to be the case in this sample. This is what the cohort looked like. It was 56% male and 43% female. The median age was 42, and I always say this: Massachusetts is not the most racially and ethnically diverse place in the United States. But I always like to say that we do celebrate diversity, we just don't have it. And this sample kind of illustrates that. It's 82% white, about 18% non-white. The things for which individuals were arrested, and I'll just zoom through this, because when we got the Corey records, and I should probably tell you a little bit about what the Corey records are. They simply are, they're designed to be the things that, they're not. It's not a research database. It's designed to be the kind of thing where if you're hiring someone to work at your nursing home or drive your school bus or something like that, or work in a healthcare facility, they will do a Corey check on you, and you will. That means that they will type in a certain set of identifiers, and if you have any arrest records, and that's what Corey records are, they're records of actually records of arraignment. They will show up that you were arrested and arraigned for any number of charges. It's hard to figure out exactly what the disposition of those cases are, but that's a discussion for another time. But has significant policy implications. Nonetheless, when we looked at the charges that people were facing, boy, there's a lot of things you can get arrested for. So we had to, including some really bizarre things like driving an overweight truck, for example, or willful retention of library materials, or one of my current favorite that we just noticed the other day as we were looking at some additional data, alien with a firearm, which invites all sorts of wonderful cartoons, and at some point we'll find one. We categorized these into serious violent crimes, which included, as you can see, some really serious kinds of things. I should point out one thing here, by the way. This is perhaps a little bit tangential, but nonetheless it bears mention. You'll notice under serious violent crime there are a couple of categories which people in this particular cohort were particularly at risk for being arrested for. One was an assault against a person over 65. The other was an assault against a disabled person. If the police choose to slap this charge on a person, and unless it gets dismissed, a person who lives, for example, with their parents, an adult person with serious mental illness who lives with a family member, and if that family member is over 65 and they get into a pushing and shoving confrontation, which police officers tell me is not an unusual scenario for being called, they can actually be charged with a felony violent crime. The same is true if they assault a fellow if they live in a residential program and get in a physical altercation with another person living in their residential program, they have technically assaulted a disabled person. Whether or not these are actually prosecuted, of course, isn't clear, but it does a couple of things. One, it points out the kind of perhaps the unfairness of these laws as they apply to people in this population, but also because if one is only surrounded by people who, if you do get in a physical confrontation with them, will generate a felony, that puts one at some legal risk. The other thing I think is that it inflates the serious violent crime category, and I've been reminded of this a couple of people, and I feel like I feel an obligation to mention it. There are less serious crimes against persons, domestic violence that don't result in a serious violent crime, some simple assault stuff, indecent sexual assault not rising to the level of rape, violations of restraining orders, which there are quite a few. Assault and battery on a police officer, which everyone told us up front was going to be a fairly common charge, turned out not to be. The serious property offenses included things like burglary and welfare fraud. Uttering, which is, if I've learned nothing from this study, I learned that uttering is actually the physical act of passing a bad check. How many of you knew that? Couple of people did. Okay. Yeah, see? The rest of you have learned something. Okay. from this presentation. Breaking and entering, motor vehicle theft, and so on. Less serious property crimes. Again, you know, what you're arrested for is what the police think you've done. You know, if you steal something and you don't look at the price tag first, you can be charged either with a felony or a misdemeanor. Motor vehicle offenses, which, you know, 8% of people had motor vehicle offenses. When you think about the things for which people with serious mental illness are charged, motor vehicle offenses aren't the first thing that come to mind. On the other hand, if you think about the fact that many people with serious mental illness are poor, many of these kinds of offenses, operating without a license, without insurance, attaching plates illegally, these are things which occur among people who don't have the money to get their license, insure their car, or register it. And leaving the scene of an accident and driving while intoxicated are also included here. Finally, we have things that we've categorized as nuisance crimes, crimes against public order, crimes against public decency, drug offenses. When we looked at these, in fact, we have a paper in Psych Services this month where we talk about this particular set of charges. And one of the things that was of concern about this particular set of charges was that it not only included things like possession of marijuana, but it also included things like possession with intent to distribute and manufacturing, which suggests to me that there are some people in our population who can make extra money or perhaps get drugs by participating in drug distribution efforts, which can get them into enormous amounts of trouble, not the least of which is the fact that they can become ineligible for Section 8 housing if they've had a drug charge and even unable to move in with a family member who lives in public housing. So these are serious charges. And then miscellaneous charges. These are just the things like the overweight truck and the library stuff and the alien with a firearm and a bunch of other things that at some point we should write up as a, you know, what you can get arrested for in Massachusetts. What I wanted to talk about today was not just the distribution or the characterization of characterizing these offenses, and we have a couple of papers, if anyone's interested, where we've talked about what the actual prevalence of these arrests were within the general population. What we really want to talk about today is taking this discussion a little bit further beyond simply saying how many people got arrested in a 10-year observation period. What we really wanted to talk about is what those arrest patterns looked like over that time period. And this is something that mental health services researchers have not, this is a kind of statistical technique that has not been used a whole lot within the public health community or with mental health services researchers, but that if this was the American Criminological Society instead of the American Public Health Association, this methodology would be all over the place. They would say this was so 90s, but you know, we're catching up. This is the trajectory analysis, and there are a couple of different approaches to it. Some of them come out of the growth curve methodologies that some of you may be familiar with. The one we use is the one that seems to be the most popular with criminologists, and developed by a guy named Dan Nagin, who's at Case Western Reserve, at Carnegie Mellon. And it's called the zero inflated Poisson model. And it comes out of the developmental criminology tradition, where the idea was, the big question was, do juvenile offenders go on to become adult offenders? And do some people persist or do they desist? This is the big question. And what is the pattern of offending over time, and how does that change with age? What this does, let me just, quick show of hands, how many people have familiarity with this methodology? Okay, a few, but not a lot, I guess. Okay. The idea here is to identify a set of temporal patterns of offending, and to derive, to identify a set of groups within your sample that share a particular set of kind of temporal, that share these temporal patterns. It's a little, the idea is that the trajectory analysis, or PROC-TRAJ was what we used in SAS. PROC-TRAJ will take all of the arrest dates, and it will look for an optimal solution that will be a set of temporal patterns or trajectories that kind of maximize the group's overall temporal patterns, and it looks for an optimal mathematical fit. And so operationally, this is a little bit like cluster analysis. The idea is you have a large number of individuals, each of whom has his or her own pattern of arrests. And within that pattern, within that group of arrests, you look to see if there are some common patterns, subgroups, and you try to identify those groups based on those temporal patterns. And then once you have, individuals become assigned to a trajectory group, the same way they would as if you were doing cluster analysis. And you can then model group membership the way you do using LOGIT or multinomial LOGIT or whatever technique is appropriate to try to figure out if you can predict who is at risk for having what kinds of patterns. And this was something that the Dan Nagin and the other developmental criminology folks, John Laub, Rob Sampson, those folks, were doing extensively in the 1990s to try to understand the pathways between juvenile delinquency and adult offending. In our particular case, we looked at the temporal patterns of arrest in our sample with this trajectory analysis. Of course, in order to be part of a trajectory analysis, you really need to be arrested more than once, because you can't really, you're ideally drawing a line over a 10-year period, and of course you need 2 points for a line, right? In our sample, 2,744 people, and I should have put the percent in, then I didn't, were arrested once, and about 1,100 were arrested two or more times. When we dumped all of this information into PROC-TRAJ, we got a 5-trajectory solution that proved to be the mathematically optimal model. I would say I've just summarized I guess that's a complete sentence, a process that took more than 6 months. This is any of you who've done this. This is like cluster analysis in a sense that sometimes you feel like it's more art than science. You know, you get clusters that you can't quite figure out how this could possibly be, or and you try it, various approaches to it, and I wish that Steve Banks were here. Well, for any number of reasons, I wish Steve Banks were here, but he could give you more detail about the tortuous path to this 5-cluster solution. This is a little hard to see, but we're very proud of this. This represents, this took almost as long as mapping the human genome, of course, way more important and far more informative. At least it's easier to look at. What we have here are 5. This is what you get, and we got 5 groups. And I know this is going to be kind of hard to see, and I will summarize this. But this looks at the y-axis looks at the number of arrests over the period, and this looks at the time period. And just to give you to orient you here, you see this, for those of you who can see this yellow, I apologize for the color scheme, by the way, this was a tough one. You can see that this is a group that starts out at the beginning of the observation period, and it with lots of arrests in the early period, and then kind of declines toward the end of the observation period. You have other groups here, for example, this one that is kind of stable over time. They average about 1 arrest a year. There's another group here that averages less than 1 arrest a year. And there's another group there that has been averaging about 2, and then they kind of decline to 0. Criminologists would call all of these paths desistants, although if you're the state mental health agency, you would be concerned about these people who appear to desist but nonetheless continue to offend at the end of the period. Now, let me just make one point here. As we began looking at this, these data, it occurred to me that what we're doing here is really something very different, which is why I wanted to present it in this particular at this particular meeting. What we're doing here is something very different from what the developmental criminology people do. What we're doing is looking not so much at how people change with age, because we have people here from 18 to 56. What we're really looking at is how a group of mental health service recipients offend over a 10-year period. So what we're really doing is, in a sense, clustering mental health service recipients on a particular dimension, which happens to be their temporal arrest patterns. Now, this is to summarize what went on in here and what we were able to discern from looking at these trajectories. This is trajectory one. This is about 30% of the sample. They had one charge early, and they dropped off to an average of near zero. So these are averaged one charge early and averaged dropping off to near zero. And as you can kind of see, that the mean number of each of these charges, you know, there were the poverty crimes, as we described them, the things that the shoplifting, the stealing a candy bar, the trespassing, that kind of thing, had the highest rate in this group. Some of the serious property crime stuff was also high in there. This was a group that engaged in a few violent crimes, but not a lot. Very little sex crime, not too much drug crime. Category two, stable across the time period, about one arrest every couple of years. Again, the poverty crimes that everybody talks about were certainly in evidence here. The nuisance crimes, were in evidence as well. This was not a group that engaged in a lot of drug crimes, but did have a fair amount of motor vehicle crimes. This would probably be a group that was reasonably poor, that demonstrated a lot of things related to their poverty. Trajectory three, again, poverty crimes win, but if you look at the mean number of these poverty crimes, they're really, really high. And this is a group that continued to get arrested on a kind of continual basis, averaging one arrest per year. Trajectory four, again, the poverty crimes win. The violent crimes and the serious property crimes are also in evidence here. Conspiracy crimes, drug crimes are around, but not terribly high. Finally, trajectory five, this is a group that if I were a state mental health agency commissioner, I would be concerned about. This is the group, if you recall, that started out really high, that had an average of about five arrests in the first year, and descended but ended with an average of still more than one, but demonstrated a lot of poverty crime, a lot of serious property crimes, and this is a group of people who is liable to be troublesome to a state mental health agency, because these are the people who are liable to be the jail. This is a group that I look at and think that, well, this could be one of the jail diversion populations that would be a kind of rapid cycler through jail diversion and reentry programs. So finally, what can trajectories tell us? Well, they identify patterns of arrests that raise, I think, different levels of concern and different service implications. We have some low-level offenders that get, you know, the average about one arrest per year, and one could argue that, well, you know, that might not be such a big deal, and the system can kind of tolerate that, versus people who are very active and seem to have a great deal of criminal justice involvement, which gets them in trouble, which interrupts mental health services, and about whom we would like to learn more to see if there is what preventive measures, if any, we could be taking with these. Clusters have members, and we can model the group membership. I have to say, we didn't really have tremendous. We were working with administrative data sets here. We didn't really have the kind of fine detail within this data this data set that would allow us to model the group membership. But I do think that it's important to try to see what characteristics, if any, predict which one of these trajectories people land in. Because I think particularly this group five worries me. They're small, but they're annoying if you're the state mental health agency. And some of them are also liable to commit crimes that are reasonably serious. And finally, I think we can look in greater detail. I didn't really have time to talk about it that much today, but I think these trajectories do suggest that high levels of involvement seem to be associated with different sorts of offending patterns. Now, what can we do with this for mental health agencies? Well, state mental health agencies and mental health services researchers have a long history, a long tradition of attempting to classify people based on a variety of characteristics, including diagnostic categories. Those of you who've been around for a long time may remember, I think it was Gordon Fries and his resource utilization groups, which tried to cluster people based on the resources they used. Bill Rubin, who has a methodology for looking at service use clustering. The trajectories here focus on a problem that's kind of external to these agencies, but one which, because they run forensic mental health services and jail diversion programs and whatnot, feel that as mental health agencies they own these problems to some extent. And so understanding over what a 10-year pattern of offending might be would be perhaps useful in figuring out what kind of resources one would need to allocate to this. Again, I guess I would go back to my second slide and say that I think this would be a useful thing to do, but on the other hand, until we all get it down so that it's really easy, without Steve Banks, it's sort of hard. anyway, so that's that. Thank you.